KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Oakland, California.
San Leandro.
I live in West Berkeley.
El Cerrito.
I live in Pinole.
Coming up, we'll get an update on a controversial plan for the future of ranching at Point Reyes National Seashore.
All the ranches will get 20-year leases, and park rangers will manage one of the park's three tule elk herds.
Then we chop it up about food and culture with the Splendid Table's Francis Lamb.
My stories as a writer were about telling the stories of invisible people and connecting to them through food.
And from Audiograph, we'll hear one man's talent show up in an unlikely place. Where's that? Stay tuned. Cross Currents is coming up. Last month, we aired a story about the future of ranching in Point Reyes National Seashore from our environment reporter, Angela Johnston. We heard from ranchers who'd been working the land for generations.
It was our belief that, you know, we would be here for at least as long as we're getting along. And we made significant investments in the dairy industry especially.
We heard from the environmentalists who thought continued ranching would hurt the landscape and the wild elk that roam free.
It's like, well, what is the purpose of a national park? Is it to prioritize taking care of wildlife? After all, where are they going to go?
And we heard from the Park Service, whose job it was to come up with a plan addressing the future of all these different aspects.
It's our job to take care of the cultural resources. So it's a great mission. It's challenging and complicated.
Well, the park has finally released its draft plan, so KALW's Angela Johnston joins me now to explain some of the changes. Hey, Angela.
Hey, Hannah.
So you've been reporting up there for a while now. Give us a taste of what you learned about ranching in the park.
Well, one thing I learned is that the National Seashore was created back in the 60s and 70s thanks to the ranchers. Many of them sold their land to the park and leased it back in return. Back then, there were tons of dairies all over Point Reyes. I'm not sure if you've been up there.
Mm-mm.
Yeah, you see a few now, but these farm families have been there for generations. Mm. And in the 1800s, they shipped butter to San Francisco by schooner.
Mm.
Today, there are 24 beef and dairy ranches in the park, but for a while, their future was pretty unclear.
And why is that?
Well, back in 2017, some environmental groups sued the Park Service to get what's called an environmental impact statement, looking at how the ranches were impacting the natural landscape.
Like, in what ways?
Well, environmental groups have been concerned about overgrazing on the hillsides and cow poop running off into streams. And so before the park extended any of those ranching leases, the lawsuit required them to take a really long, hard look at whether or not these ranchers can responsibly stay and operate side by side with the wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
So the park did a study, and it looked at the impacts of keeping the ranches and the cows or just getting rid of them altogether, and then all of these other different scenarios in between.
Okay, so what plan did they choose to move forward with?
So out of all these options that they studied, they chose what they're calling Alternative B. It's this middle ground that protects both the ranches and the wildlife. And all the ranches will get 20-year leases, and park rangers will manage one of the park's three tule elk herds, so making sure the herd doesn't get above a certain number.
Okay, and remind us why tule elk need managing in Point Reyes.
So the Drake's Beach elk herd is free-ranging, and they often get onto ranchers' land and compete for food with cows. And ranchers really don't like this.
Mm-hmm.
And so elk also don't have any natural predators. We don't have grizzly bears on Point Reyes anymore. Another thing is that too many elk take a toll on the land as well.
Okay, so how are the parks proposing to manage the herd?
Now, this is controversial. The plan allows rangers to kill about 10 to 15 elk each year, and they would donate the meat. So the rangers can't really move the elk outside the park, and that's done in other places. They actually airlift elk. And they can't do that because some of the herd in Point Reyes has a disease that can spread to other animals. But environmentalists are really, really upset. I spoke to activist Jeff Miller at the Center for Biological Diversity, and they're one of the main groups that sued the Park Service to get this all started in the first place.
Uh-huh.
One of the first things he said to me was that, quote, this elk killing plan was insanity and that the Park Service has lost their mind.
Why was he saying that?
Well, overall, he doesn't think a single elk should be shot in a national park. He doesn't think any piece of wildlife should be mm-hmm. killed, mm-hmm. especially in a park that has actually spent decades trying to reintroduce the species after it disappeared from the landscape. So he and other environmentalists continually cite the mission of the National Park Service, and I'll read that to you right now. It's, the National Park Service preserves unimpaired the natural and cultural resources and values of the national park system for the enjoyment, education, and inspiration of this and future generations.
A mouthful.
Right. And he says that shooting elk isn't preserving the natural resources the park has to offer.
But there's also the word cultural in there.
Right. And so when I spoke to the Point Reyes National Seashore, they really stressed that word cultural. And that's where the balance comes in, because the 24 beef and dairy ranches are historic. And officials of the park say they count as this cultural resource, and elk disturbing them, you know, they have to balance these two things.
And how are the ranchers reacting to this? Are they happy?
Yeah, the ones I talked to are on board. And remember, these ranching families have been here for multiple generations, and leaving or having challenges like elk on their land would mean more than just a loss of a job. Mm. And there's this also entire West Marin economy that's built up around these ranches and Point Reyes Station and other areas, like the veterinarians, the cheesemakers, the people who supply the feed.
Mm-hmm. So what else about the new plan caught your attention?
Well, part of the new plan includes some rezoning to protect certain areas from overgrazing and pollution, but also to allow for some new activities like commercially raising new kinds of livestock. So you might see pigs or goats or chickens or sheep up there. And ranchers will also be allowed to grow some non-irrigated row crops like rye grass or oats, and they'll also be able to make cheese.
Okay, but we just talked about the culture. This seems like a huge departure from the cattle-only history that the park has. Why did they do it?
Yeah, it is a big departure. And the Park Service tells me they met one-on-one with ranchers many times throughout the planning process. And ranchers told staff they needed more opportunities for diversification.
Mm-hmm.
So organic prices have dropped as more people buy organic. You can find organic milk and beef everywhere. So the prices have gone down, and ranchers aren't making as much of a profit on their product.
Mm-hmm.
So the ability to change things up should make ranchers a lot more flexible over the next 20 years. And there's also this option now to organize farm tours and farm stays on these historic ranches. So there's another way for them to make an extra bit of money.
And how are environmentalists responding to this, new farm animals in addition to cows?
Well, Jeff Miller with the Center for Biological Diversity says this is just another recipe for conflicts with native wildlife like the elk. He says if ranchers have sheep or pigs or chickens and coyotes start messing with those animals, what's to say ranchers won't want to start killing them too? The new plan does say ranchers won't be able to do this, but Miller says if elk are now up for debate, he suspects coyotes and other wildlife might be too.
Okay, so what is next?
Well, the public comment period, we're in this public comment period for the plan. It lasts until September 28th, and we can post the link online so anyone listening can share their thoughts. The park will consider all of them and present a final plan. And they say there's always something that could change, but they expect the plan to look quite similar to this draft one and hope that everything will be official and in place by next year. As for groups like Miller's and the environmentalists who sued in the first place, they say they'll be looking at different legal arguments to maybe take it to court again.
Okay, thanks, Angela.
Thank you.
Angela Johnston is our environment reporter.
Thank you.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Francis Lam grew up in New Jersey to Chinese-American parents who dreamed of him becoming a dentist or a lawyer. But when he said he wanted to be a writer, well, they weren't exactly thrilled. But then they saw that first byline and they were convinced. Francis would then go on to be a multiple James Beard Award-winning food writer and the host of the popular food and culture show, The Splendid Table. He joins me now. Francis Lam, welcome.
Thank you, Hannah.
Well, welcome to the show and welcome to KLW and actually welcome to the San Francisco airwaves.
It is truly such a thrill. Can't even say how excited we are that we get to be on your air.
New to our airwaves, the show for curious cooks and eaters. That sounds like you're describing everyone in the Bay Area, basically. This show was made for here.
We have been wanting to be there for a long time.
But for folks who are getting this for the first time, how would you describe the show? What is it supposed to do?
The show's been around for nearly 25 years.
Right.
And with the previous host, Lynn Rosetta Casper, who's a hero of mine, wonderful. She was a fabulous cooking teacher. She, in fact, like ran cooking schools for many years. And I came up as a fan listening to the show. And my career prior to being on the show was similar in that I feel like we had very similar interests, but I wrote less about cooking and the how-tos of cooking, although I did do plenty of that. It's something I am passionate about for sure. But a lot of my stories as a writer were about telling the stories of invisible people and first connecting to them through food. Mm. So I had a column for a few years at the New York Times Magazine where every month I would go into the home of someone who was from a different immigrant community in New York City, and they would teach me to make something, but in the course of our cooking together, they would usually teach me something about their lives or something about where they came from or their hopes and dreams, or sometimes the stories would be incredibly personal, incredibly beautiful and heartbreaking. And for me, I always felt like, well, man, if so this person is sharing this with me, it's not just a gift to me, but now it's a responsibility of mine to take that story and help put it out in the world, right? Mm-hmm. And so I kind of feel like we do this show that is definitely in the tradition of the show that Lynn started 20-some-odd years ago, but now with maybe a little bit more of an eye towards the cultural element of food, maybe a little bit more of an eye towards the personal stories, maybe a little bit more of an eye towards the politics of what we're eating. These are things the show has always dealt with. But I think now we're just freer to be a little more curious and not think of ourselves so focused as a cooking show. Mm-hmm. And we are a show about curiosity.
Because the stories of people add what?
You know, I think it's not even about what they add. It's sort of like what the food lets us get to. Mm. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to say, well, the food tastes better if you know the story behind it. It's a little bit of a truism in food, and it's fair. But for us, it's not even like, hey, I want to talk to you about your tacos, and then let's talk about, like, where you came from. You know, it's more like, I'm really curious about what you've seen and who you are as a person and what you're interested in. And if I were to meet you in a bar and I didn't know how to talk to you, maybe the first thing I would do is ask you about what you ate when you were growing up. Mm-hmm. And that's like, it's almost like the icebreaker. And because we can share a lot in common there, and I can tell you what I ate and what's delicious and what you're excited about and what you want to eat, you know, what you're excited to eat this weekend or mm-hmm. whatever. And then once we've established that as a baseline, a way to sort of connect, it's almost like if the metaphor was like, oh, now the wires are crossed, like we've crossed our wires, and then we can have like full transmittal and full transmission, and mm-hmm. we can talk about other things too. I feel like the story often for me starts with the food and goes anywhere else mm-hmm. rather than have the story and end in the food.
Bay Area, lots of variety, richness in the food scene here, as we said. Mm-hmm. Where do you go when you're in town?
Oh, man, you're going to make me pick?
Other than boba, guys.
I mean, I have to say, really, truly, and this is like, yeah, I think the East Coast, West Coast beef is over. Like, it was over in rap a long time ago, and I think it probably ended in food, too. But the fact is, like, pound for pound, there is no city in the country, probably the world, that has a food scene that can match the Bay Area's. I mean, the richness of climates, the richness of produce you have, the diversity of communities, although I know obviously that the it's tricky to say that in a place that's like really dealing a lot with gentrification and people being priced out of their own communities, but the richness of heritages and cultures that have come there over time, and the richness of like innovation and the chef community there that really push each other to do exciting new things, and frankly, a market that appreciates that and also like at certain segments of society has the money and willingness to spend that money on that really creates for like a top to bottom food scene that is unlike anything in the country.
It's a wonderful, wonderful show. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
And I'm going to end by asking a question that as a journalist, you probably ask all the time as well at the beginning of an interview, because it would be lovely to hear, what did you have for breakfast this morning, Francis Lamb?
Oh, this
it
is
better
like the
be good. No pressure.
Studio engineer question. Yeah, like just to get a level, what did you have for
just
breakfast?
Just to get a level, what did you have for breakfast this morning?
Okay, my truth is this, I almost never eat breakfast. I know it's the most important meal, yada yada. I almost never eat breakfast, and I did not eat breakfast today. However, I will tell you that I heard one of my favorite answers to that question while I was sitting in this very studio and interviewing someone else, a James Beard Award-winning food media person, and he said, man, I had a bowl of Cap'n Crunch.
Oh, no. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
My other favorite answer to that question was when someone was like, oh, and she was like trying to think of like what she might say that would sound like appropriately foodie. And she's like, I had cigarettes.
Well, we know not to ask any James Beard Award winners that question anymore.
We are just like the rest of y'all.
Cap'n Crunch. Okay. Well, Francis Lamb, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Francis Lamb is host of the podcast The Splendid Table from American Public Media. You can hear it every Saturday at 1 p.m. right here on KALW. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Next up, an audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. This one from our archives is by reporter Julie Kane, and she's the creator of the audiograph series. She made this one a few years ago when she heard the sound of a man singing opera in downtown San Francisco.
We are at Powell Street at the Turnaround in San Francisco, California, of course. The only place where you'll hear something like this, more than likely. My name is Tim Blevins, better known alias Opera. Everybody calls me Opera. I have a degree in music and voice, and I've actually worked around the world. I'm unemployed at the moment, so I'm just singing, you know, wherever.
And what is it about opera that really speaks to your soul? Like, why opera?
I don't know. I mean, when I started singing opera, I was in, I was 23. I was in college, and I heard a Verdi piece, and it was Otello. It was Iago's aria from Otello, and you know, the hair stood up on my, you know, I got goosebumps.
Quando la
tua meta già vedo. It's just so dramatic, it's, you know, and then the story behind it, if you know what's going on behind it, it's just, the music, musically is just incredible.
And Othello is about what, in a nutshell?
He's a black man, actually, he's a Moor. And Iago was his nemesis, you know. Iago was trying to set him up so that he would, he thought that his girl, Desdemona, I think her name is, was cheating on him. And he kills her, you know. And so, you know, that's basically what most opera plots are about. You know, some guy loves another guy's woman and they kill, you know, in order to get the woman, they kill that, you know. And then the lady kills herself, you know, just some crazy stuff, you know.
That was Tim Blevins, whose singing you may have heard on San Francisco streets. Thanks to Julie Kane for that audiograph segment. And you can find more signature sounds from the Bay Area at KALW.org. And while you're there, make sure you're subscribed to the Cross Currents newsletter. Get all the interviews and stories and more in your inbox every week. Tune in Monday at 5. A new tool used by the DA removes race from police reports.
Race sometimes could be a descriptor in order to identify somebody, but it should never be used as a predictor that because you happen to be purple, you're more likely to commit robberies as somebody that happens to be green.
Using AI to tackle inherent bias, Monday at 5 on Cross Currents. And now for some local music. This is Silverware from San Francisco. They're going to perform at the Right Spot tomorrow night.
Keeping the lights off, 'cause I don't want to wake you. I dress in the darkness.
Today's Cross Currents team includes Taylor Caldwell, Janae Darden, Ariella Markowitz, Kristen McCandless, True Quinn, Marissa Ortega Welch, and Michael Locke Swingin. Our engineers are James Rowlands, Tariq Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shireen Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.